What's that dish? Hello and welcome back to the Food Safety Dish, a podcast brought to you by National Farmers Union's Local Food Safety Collaborative, where we dig into the stories behind the food we eat, as well as those of the people who grow it. I'm your host, Catherine Cavanaugh, and today we're inquiring into the past and future of ancient grains by looking at the present work of Southern Oregon's Rogue Valley Heritage Grain Project. Imagine our world 10,000 years ago. Your community hunters are out trying to score a big dinner, and meanwhile, one of your gatherer friends discovers some remarkable plants that are delicious, easily stored, and freely available in your local environment. How incredible! Maybe you realize that some of the plants you actually dropped on your nomadic route last year have sprouted anew into even more of the plants you loved in this place you've been before. Through a series of trial and error, humans realized that certain edible seeds of wild grasses they were gathering could be planted in place by their own hands. Humans began a cultural evolution, transitioning from hunter-gatherer communities to more permanent agricultural ones. And the plants that enabled this were grains. Early agricultural communities began cultivating wild grasses, sparking a revolution that would shape human history. The domestication of grain crops like wheat, barley, and rye were the cornerstones of agriculture, enabling civilizations, much like bread, to rise and societies to flourish. Fast forward to the 20th century. Before the 1950s, America was a tapestry of local grain production. Small farms and mills were numerous, embedded in a network of regional food systems. The advent of the Green Revolution brought sweeping changes with it, with new technologies and high-yield grain varieties transforming agriculture and feeding a population boom. Grain was one of the first crops to become mechanized, offering a respite from the multiple stages of labor-intense harvesting and processing. While these advances fed millions, perhaps humans got almost too good at the industrial game they catalyzed. In time, this also led to unintended consequences. The loss of America's extensive small farm and mill networks, a mounting loss of crop diversity due to industrial efficiency, and over the course of only a few generations, a rise in gluten intolerance and diet-related diseases that were not seen before the industrialization of grain. Despite progress, we've developed a new set of problems. Yet, amidst these challenges, there are regional revivals of more holistic approaches. The Rogue Valley Heritage Grain Project, led by the passionate farmer Chris Hardy, is reviving ancient grain and heritage grains in Southern Oregon for current and future generations. With a rich living seed bank of rare and resilient seeds from Central Asia, the Himalayas, and the Middle East, the project is cultivating over 150 unique varieties of heritage grains and legumes to ensure a secure and healthy regional food future. These grains promise not only nutrition and adaptability to dry conditions, but also flourish with sustainable and resource-conscious farming practices. The project has made great strides, increasing local heritage grain production, sharing seeds with growers, and integrating these grains into local food systems, including school lunch programs. By embracing these ancient grains, we have the chance to build healthier soils, nourish our communities, and create a more resilient agricultural landscape. Of course, a grain renaissance may just be delicious too, an important added benefit that can make a world a difference. Join us as we explore the rich history, present challenges, and promising future of ancient grains in Southern Oregon. Together, let's learn how these humble crops can pave the way for healthier soil, healthier people, and a brighter future as we hear from farmers that are sowing dreams for a better food system into fruition. Thanks for being a part of the Food Safety Dish. Welcome to the show. I would love for you all to introduce yourselves and give us an idea of who you are, where you're coming from, and what kind of farming you're doing.
I guess I'll start. So my name is Steve Fry. I'm a owner of the Fry Family Farm, me and my wife and my daughters. Actually, I'm now a co-owner with my daughters. We made it a woman-owned business, so they stole some of my shares. Used to be 50-50 split with my wife. Now we have the kids in there, so it's a family-run business. We've been here for 35 years in Medford, Oregon. We run about 100 or so acres of vegetables, flowers, and now grains. I've been doing grains now for what, Chris, 3 years, 4 years? And yeah, it's busy. We're planting, we're harvesting, we do vegetables, and we're starting to bring in zucchini and stuff like that. So it's really starting to amp up. So yeah, I've been probably farming. My daughter, you wanted a bio. My daughter says, "Well, you were farming when I was born, right?" Yeah. Well, I'm 42 years old, so I've been doing this for 42 years, believe it or not. We started with a half acre in Talent, Oregon. And when we moved to Oregon, we started with a half acre. I had a tractor and a tiller. And now we're over 100 acres. So it's been good to us. Yeah. Chris, who are you?
Thank you, Catherine, and all for pulling this together. I'm Chris Hardy. I've been farming for more than 20 years. We own and operate Hardy Seeds based in Southern Oregon. I guess we kind of kicked that off in 2015. Our seed company, and we're working with a lot of different heritage grains and herbs and vegetables and regenerative potential crops. We initiated the Rogue Valley Heritage Grain Project back in 2019, but have been growing and trialing heritage grains and ancient grains for, boy, a lot of years, I guess, since probably around 2005, 2006. And have kept with some of those varieties that we've been saving seeds on and selecting for Southern Oregon's challenging growing conditions that can range from, in our Intermountain Oregon climate here, we, get down into the teens and even colder, it's been below zero here. And we get all the way up to, I think the record was like 116 degrees we had a couple of years ago. Our average summer temperatures can hang out in like the 90, 95 degree range and often get up into the hundreds and 105 for weeks. And so we have some really like extreme challenges. And so pretty stoked to be working with these heritage grains and with the growers. Of the three dozen or so growers that we are working with here in the Rogue Valley and the Southern Oregon, Northern California bioregion, to see what varieties are best fit for dry farming and climate extremes and nutritional improvements that we are working with over 200 varieties of heritage, landrace, and ancient grains and legumes from all over the world, from dozens of countries. And many of the places that I've traveled to in my day, traveled to over 50 countries, and really excited to be working with these varieties from some of the places where I've traveled and had the most amazing experiences hanging out with farmers and eating and enjoying food from faraway lands. And oftentimes, these farmers are growing with low input systems and reduced tillage. And they don't have like rotavators and things that just kind of destroy soil structure. They have ox or yaks and rudimentary plows, and people are doing it like appropriate technology, low scale methods of food production and subsistence. And not saying that per se I'm interested to return to subsistent living, but it definitely is closer to what I saw in these parts of the world of Central Asia, the Caucasus Mountains, Eastern Europe, the Indian subcontinent, Nepal, and Kyrgyzstan, and other places where I've spent time, that just seemed more in alignment with nature and the natural systems. And so I'm just really excited about working with these seeds because of their ability to regenerate soils and return the health of our farmland back to what it was before the advent of the Green Revolution and this new way of that we've been using in our agricultural systems here for the past half a century or so. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for sharing all of that. I think it's very interesting to consider that the way forward is, you know, we have to look back to look forward. And you definitely touched a lot on this, but could you just talk about what was the catalyst that originated the Rogue Valley Heritage Grain Project, and how did you find the heritage seeds, and how did you choose which ones were the ones that you wanted to start growing?
Yeah, sure. So I guess things really ramped up in our connection with a lot of these heritage grains when we partnered with the Rocky Mountain Seed Alliance, but mostly we were a grain trialist for their Heritage Grain Project. And I saw the need and knew some of the history of the Rogue Valley that we did not have these seeds in production for decades here, like used to be done in the Rogue Valley. And so as a trialist with the Rocky Mountain Seed Alliance Grain Trials Program, which is now defunct, and so these seeds that were kind of becoming like reaching out across the country are now basically like not really available through the trials program. There's the Heritage Grain Alliance that my friends Leanne Hill and Bill McDormand started the Heritage Grain Alliance after the Rocky Mountain Seed Alliance became Seeds of Commons, Seeds of the Commons, or Seeds in Common. And so, yeah, these seeds are not effectively being grown and propagated and gotten out to other growers across the United States. So we see that there's like a super important role right now for the growers of heritage grains to not only grow them, to get to know them, but also to preserve the seeds and perpetuate these seeds, to continue to make these seeds available. In my travels, I brought back some of the seeds from Central Asia, the Caucasus, Ladakh. I've been to Ladakh, aka Little Tibet, three times, three different trips. And the culture there is just really connected to the earth and very spiritual. It's very remote and extremely difficult to access because you have to go over five mountain passes that are greater than 16,000 feet elevation. And it's sandwiched between China, Pakistan, Kashmir, and India. And so it's like just extremely rugged, dry. It's on the edge of the Gobi Desert. So we brought back some of these seeds. Some of them are threatened. Their existence is threatened due to the modern agricultural system that is basically bringing in subsidized chickpeas, lentils, barley, wheat from India. And rice. And it's like, well, rice doesn't grow down on the valley floor at 14 and 15,000 feet elevation. And so it's like a complete disconnect with what would be proper for the community of Ladakh. Instead, they truck over many mountain passes all the rice and subsidized chickpeas and lentils, of which have been a core part of their culture for centuries. And now these very specific varieties of heritage and landrace crops are near extinction. And so I'm really grateful to be working with some of these seeds in our trials, and just to get to know them and understand them and understand like how it next to the Gobi Desert, 15, 16,000 feet elevation where these seeds have been grown again for centuries, that they're so drought tolerant and require less inputs, less water, one of the driest agricultural communities on the planet, hands down, that they're seeing the glaciers dry up, the water dry up, because of the glaciers are just becoming smaller and smaller. And that glacier flow is what has helped them irrigate their crops. Again, they don't get a lot of snow anymore. They don't get much rain. And so they're using these glaciers that are, it's soon they're just going to run out of water. And so we're really hoping to preserve some of these seeds, not only to return to the farmers who shared with us these seeds, but to also share and bring light to the situation that's changing climate right now. And of course, the social disconnect that the new generations of kids don't understand that their mother and father and grandparents saved those seeds for a reason. And it was because of this connection with the nature, natural systems there. And instead, they're more connected to things that require more tillage, more fertilizer, more inputs, instead of the opposite, because we live in these times that disconnect people from the fact that we're stealing fertility from other communities to be able to carry out these practices of unsustainable agriculture.
Mm. That's a really great explanation and very interesting methodology of finding that stuff. You talked a little bit about the bioregion of the Rogue Valley, how it has these intense extremes. Can you talk a little bit more about dry farming and how that adapts to the region, and how specifically you came to choose this method of farming? Was that something that you always knew about, or did you have to learn about that throughout your years of farming?
Yeah, so the dry farming, we had some major incidences happen here in Southern Oregon. One of them was a major fire that burned three towns in our valley. And they're kind of the heart of the Rogue Valley, actually. And that was a kind of a wake-up call as to how dry it was and just kind of how we were not really in touch with those realities about water scarcity, about what it would take to grow food without just acting like we had unlimited access to water. Mm-hmm. 'Cause actually part of the Rogue Valley's water comes from the Klamath Basin, which is in part in Oregon, but actually that basin heads into Northern California. And so the early settlers of the valley figured out a way to pipe that water down into the Rogue Valley instead of letting it in Oregon, instead of running it down into California, where the Klamath is, of course, also having challenges of its own in climate. And so that water isn't, legally, it's ours, but it's ethically it should not be ours. And so if we're to take 30% of all the water that we on our farm use and cut that down, we need to understand that water is not as abundant as we are told. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we're working with these seeds, is we're bucking the trends of a drier, mostly warmer climate, though I think it's really unpredictable whether or not we're going to get colder or hotter, or we're just ending up with like a lot of extremes. We've had frost year on year, almost every year for, I don't know, Steve, but like the past 4 or 5 years where it's been a late frost, and Steve's down in the bottom of the valley where it's a little warmer, but some of our growers are up in these little side valleys, and that it's just every year has been it's a wild card as to what we're going to get with climate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I definitely like thinking about the food security aspect of it and just preparing for the unknown future and, you know, anticipating that a lot of these resources that we're very accustomed to are probably not going to remain that way. So it's definitely good, you know, insurance to be thinking about that now and preparing for that.
Well, that's what you were saying before. You know, there used to be hundreds or thousands across the country mills, small grain mills, and they're all gone. And we're developing, our farm is going more into the, growing the essentials, dried beans. We're doing the grains. We have a flour mill. We're building the infrastructure for making flour. We're selling it to the schools. We're selling it to institutions. We'd like to get into more institutions with this stuff. It's nutritious. It has flavor. And it's low gluten, these heritage grains, ancient grains, einkorn. Einkorn is one of the first grains that was on this planet that fed humans from the beginning of time. And since the revolution after the war of Kellogg's buying all the grain mills and Cargill putting all the grain into animals, the humans have been suffering nutritionally because of feeding the cows. Mm-hmm. I like to eat cow. I don't mind eating cow, but the humans are the ones that are hurting because of our practice of corporate greed. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's what it all comes down to, corporate greed. Feeding the shareholders, okay? Small farms are being eliminated. Small farms are the only thing, as far as food security goes, that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. People growing their own flour, people being able to access their own flour from the valley, from where it's grown, local farmers. So, you know, I'm really excited about getting that movement moving forward. With Chris and his seeds, we can now grow out, 25, 30 acres of seed at a time of this heritage grain stuff. Eventually, we're going to have hundreds of acres of grain and flour. We're building the infrastructure. Like I said, we're building infrastructure to clean the seed so we can get into flour. We're buying a bigger flour mill. We anticipate the bakers love the flour. They love this stuff. It actually has flavor.
Yeah.
You know, and when you call it whole grain flour, it's literally whole grain. On the ingredients list on their bread, it says grain, whole grain. It doesn't say niacin, thiamine, all these additives that they strip away from the grain and feed it to the cows. So they have to give you the synthetic vitamins. Mm-hmm.
Maybe we can back up and talk about some soil health, because I think before we even dive into industry and thinking about the grain, I want to know, what practices do you think about when you employ, you're building soil health, right? So,
oh man, absolutely.
Maybe we can talk about that, like the very basic founding, the building blocks
totally love
the grain.
So the grain has become a rotation in my deal. I can, right now I have a Ashland farm. It's like 30 or 40 acres that is all in barley. 90% of it's in barley. We were suffering from aphids there, terribly aphid infestations. And the only way to get rid of aphids that I know of organic, I'm all certified organic. Everything I do is organic. I can grow this barley in there. And the owner of the property, I rent the property. The owner came in and she says, what is that? They don't even know what grain looks like. What are you doing with all that stuff out there? What is that? I said, it's barley. Well, what are you going to do with that? Well, feed the people. I don't know. She says, well, why? I said, well, number one, the aphid infestation out here is over the top and I cannot get rid of them. So by drying out the soil, when you're ripening the grain, it has to get dry and it's a long drying process. We don't spray it with Roundup. Every commercial grower in this continent sprays Roundup on top of this grain. I mean, everybody knows that. We know that. Not everybody knows that. So as you dry out the soil to ripen the grain, all those aphids dry up. They go away. Same here in Medford. My farm here in Medford, I've got half of it right now in grain. I'm moving all the vegetables to this other field I have in Medford next year, and this whole place will be in grain because we have flea beetle. We have, you know, infestations of beetles that you can't kill. You cannot control them. I can only use so many available insecticides, organically approved. And so the best thing about the grain is I can rotate the veg out to a field that's been in grain for a year or two. And the inputs that I put in to grow vegetables are heavy feeders, flowers are heavy feeders. I don't have to fertilize those fields to grow grain. It's the most beautiful stand of grain you'll ever see. Just from the nutrients that are in it, I don't feed it at all. I don't touch the grain. We put it in the fall and harvest it in the summer. So that ground is not touched. The infrastructure of the ground, all the bacteria, everything's working in there. Worms are working. Everybody's happy. It's not being touched. No cultivation, no interference. Vegetables are a heavily cultivated project. A lot of tillage.
With the grain, so basically you let it ripen, and then once you harvest, you just go ahead and let the rest of the stock compost into the ground? Correct. Is that what you're mentioning? Okay.
I can harvest some of the little staff, the straw. I can harvest the straw and sell some of that to like organic growers, the gardeners that want to mulch with the straw. But most of the straw will go back in the soil. See, I was a cover crop guy. I've been organic my whole life. So you have to use cover crops. So I was a barley vetch cover crop guy. That's my go-to because the barley has such great stock and all that roughage goes in there and the vetch does what it does. So barley's always been in my rotation. But now with Chris and all these different grains he's got, we've been moving them in. We're doing fields of trials. And we're growing just four seed. And all that mass, biomass, goes right back in the soil. So you're building huge biomass. He's got rye out there that's like 6 feet tall. It's unbelievable. It's tremendous biomass. And all that goes in, and then that overwinters, and then we can move veg back in there. It's really cool. Go ahead.
So it seems like the big points are rotation, low invasion in terms of pest management, cover cropping in the field, and really low intervention, it seems like.
Yes. The ground can actually take a year or two off because it's got this grain on it. And there's enough fertility in my soils that you don't have to do anything. We go out in the fall and drill seed right in the, you know, we kind of lightly disc it. Harrow it real lightly, make a seed bed, a couple inches down. We don't have no-till capabilities. This is my third year. I don't have the infrastructure for that. So we just go in, we lightly make seed bed, plant the grain. Winter comes, it irrigates it from the rain. It grows, it lives through the winter. It's fantastic.
You said you're certified organic, but can you talk about maybe your relationship with pesticides or herbicides, or if there is not a relationship, maybe, you know, the impact you've had with neighbors, or just how do pesticides play a role in the operation of the grain, whether you choose to use them or not?
I use every available pesticide I can on the veggies, veg and flowers. You know, there's a list that I can use. Okay, mm-hmm. So because I got to grow a crop that'll fit in Safeway's produce rack, my stuff has to look perfect. So I have to protect it. So with the grain, and so what happens is I only have a small list of stuff I can use out in the field. So the bugs, they die, but some of them don't. They get immune to it. So with the rotation, I can come in and I don't have to spray the grain. I don't put nothing on the grain. Zero inputs. I don't spray, I don't do anything to the grain. It just sits there. It's the most easiest thing I've ever done in my life. No, nothing to do. Plant it, drill it in the fall, harvest in the summer. Period. No inputs. It's the cleanest food you can get. People need to be eating this stuff. Man, it tastes great. Imagine that, flour that has flavor. Flour that has flavor. We need a t-shirt, Chris.
All of our the major bakers across the valley are all saying the flavor is off the chart. And these are bakers that have been baking for 10 to 20 years of their life.
Yeah.
And they're like, the flavor, it's mind blowing. And they're like, we want more of this grain in our bread products. How can we get that?
The local community is buying. We got a farm store out here in front, and we're making flour. The local community, man, we get pictures of loaves that they've grown, that they've baked, and they just, you know, it's off the charts. It's crazy. We can't keep it on the shelf.
It seems like such an obvious thing for people to do, especially if you could rotate it with your crops, barely have to touch it. And, you know, and then also I imagine the storage life of the grain is a lot. I mean, it's much longer than produce, of course. So I'm curious to hear more about the Rogue Valley Heritage Grain Grower Program that you have going. I know on your website it says that you guys have one of the largest living seed banks in the Western USA. We've talked a lot about why this is important, but if you just want to underscore why you think this is important for the variety of reasons you do, I'd love to hear a little bit more about that.
Mm. Yeah, sure. Catherine, thank you. Just the simple act of taking these seeds and planting them. I mean, I've been farming. I started farming up in Montana outside of Bozeman back in 2000. And it's grain is like a whole different deal. I mean, there's kale and there's onions, and I'm trying to think of the things that I've been growing at least for those years. You know, I've been
carrots.
Yeah. I mean, all of it. We grew like the full gamut of veg and sold everything to the Bozeman Food Co-op up there before I moved down here to Southern Oregon back in 2005, 2006, been farming since then. And that's when I really started getting into doing different grains and ancient grains and things. But mind blown when all of a sudden you have access to the USDA germ repository, access to the heritage grain trials through Rocky Mountain Seed. And all this stuff was like all of a sudden packages and packages of seeds were arriving, and mentors were sending me seeds from all across the country, and seeds that we had been planting from my travels, and putting those together with all these other varieties from Ethiopia, Syria, Palestine, Pakistan, Iran, Afghanistan, Kazakhstan, Russia, Ukraine, Estonia. Like we're growing a rye right now. I can just barely touch the 8-foot tall ceiling here in my room on my tippy toes. Going out to our rye block right now, which is almost a quarter acre of heritage grain. We have rye in the field, I would say the average height, I can barely touch the top of the rye. So that's 8 feet. There are other ryes that are taller than that. They're almost 9 feet tall. And so if you think about how modern varieties are, they're much shorter. They're built for the modern day food system, built for combines and built for all this equipment. Consistency, it has to be perfection. You don't want one thing to be this tall and one thing to be that. You want consistency, and that's what hybridization does for the food system. It's good, and that is just a classic like idea of the monocrop mindset that we have put ourselves into, that box, and that allows for, if a pest outbreaks on one, it's going to outbreak on all, because that's what hybrid uniformity is. And that's, again, just like the modern classic food system of the thousands and tens of thousands of things that are this highly ultra processed food system. It is just like that on steroids. That is what our food that we eat, put in our bodies these days, is about. And so we're working on varieties that don't have that heavy, heavy duty uniformity, and that have drought resistance, have pest resistance, disease resistance already in the genetics and in the formula. And so we're just really excited to be
Tell me about how many growers you got.
We have more than 30 growers right now. They are growing some chickpeas and some other dry farm legumes. And then, God, we probably have around 50 varieties of heritage grains that are in the hands of these growers. Why aren't all 200 varieties of what we are working with, of the varieties, in their hands? Because there's not enough growers. And you know, are all these varieties appropriate for Southern Oregon? I would say there's no reason they're not. But there are, like, for instance, there's some durums. Durum wheat is what you find in pasta. Durum wheat is what you often find in crackers. And, you know, most people just want to, they're like, oh, I just want to make bread. Most people aren't like, oh, I just want to make some spaghetti, you know. It's different. And so we have fewer growers who are growing our durum types of wheat. Incidentally, durums are the most drought tolerant wheat varieties out there. And so do we want more durum being grown in Southern Oregon, or more hard reds and hard whites and soft whites and so forth? I would say we want all of the above, to give us a hedge on the climate, unpredictable climate challenges that we have, that we are seeing today. And culturally, we want people just to be able to take these and make food with them. So we are building a culture that is going to be the new culture, the new paradigm of Southern Oregon agriculture. And we want to just give farmers the tools, as in the seeds, to be able to move forward with this work.
Yeah, that's amazing. And also, you know, if you're practicing with 200 varieties of grain, that's going to give you so much more data than if you just had five, you know, varieties of grain. So that's definitely, having that diversity of diet is, I think, only a good thing for, you know, ensuring for the future.
It's fantastic.
And another piece of that, you guys were asking, somebody was asking about what the fries are doing as far as like the soil health. Some of this material is being baled into straw, which is a vital value added product. Right now, our local farm supply stores do not have organic mulch. And so, if we want to talk about creating a culture of people, I know growers on smaller scales of 2 acres, 3 acres, 4 acres that use so much mulch and right now are having difficulties accessing organic mulch. I just had a conversation with one of the managers that manages all the grain stores in the valley. And they said that their farm supply store has no access to organic mulch. What they say instead is it's access to certified weed-free straw. And what the code word for those of the listeners right now that understand the issue, certified weed-free implies glyphosate and 2,4-D rich straw, which these individuals, these farms are putting onto their peppers, onto their potatoes, onto their tomatoes and other crops. And my family, I can say, have been core to the bone dedicated to organic, and somehow they end up with contaminated straw. It happens cyclically every few, 10 years, mom loses it, like all the potatoes get ruined from some contaminated straw or something, or she hears of the community garden that had this happen, and so on and so on and so on. And so I'm like really grateful that the Fries are up for doing this, because we do not have that source right now to get into the farm stores that people can go, and they're now going to, I'm going to be sending them right to the Fries to load up on this stuff. And the good news is, if we have rye that the Fries are going, Steve, you said it was 7 feet tall?
Yes. I don't know how I'm going to harvest it. My header only goes up, 3 feet.
So there's that amount of biomass that's visible to us when we walk out in the field.
Yeah.
These are so extremely drought tolerant, these heritage grains. If you can imagine, this is what's above the soil.
Right.
What's below the soil is extensive root systems that you do not get from modern varieties of grains that are being cranked out of these hybridized varieties out of OSU and the land grant colleges.
Oh, wait a minute, OSU. Don't talk bad about them.
Okay, OSU. But they're working on different – there's two different – parts. They're working on one part, and we are working on, and I know they were also working on, like, oh, well, how to put more carbon back in the soil. It's kind of a conundrum because the stuff.
They know about these grains. They know a lot about these grains, the heritage grains, the einkorns. They know a lot about these, but the movement has shifted to what we have now today. So now that's their thing. But you ask them a question about that, I call them in that. Boy, they were on it like that. They just knew, they have vast knowledge of all that.
Yes, I know OSU has a new employee, Bridget Mines. She's working on, apparently I just found out yesterday, she's also working on heritage legumes and things like that. So I'm like, oh, okay, that's very cool. Heritage grains, because again, most wheat is about 3 feet tall, and most of the heritage grain varieties that we're working with are 4+ feet tall, and some
I got that heritage grain down feet on their property, right in their face.
Over down on OSU. Yeah, they're going to be checking you out, Steve.
They are checking me out. Well, the PhDs. Hey. I love working with PhDs.
This is just so fascinating, guys. This is Billy from NFU popping in here. And not to derail it from the question of research and, finding all these different varieties and stuff, but I did think the point about, the need for straw and mulch and the contamination that can get introduced to, say, a certified grower, even, I know plenty of growers that want to do kind of a version of organic, best practices, sustainable, whatever you call it. And, that kind of ties into the next question that we had in the hopper, which was, how do you think these grains tie into food safety, or maybe in a larger sense, the health of the public and the health of the farming ecosystem?
Well, it's a food safety thing, because you're eating a certified organic grain That's a whole grain. Okay. You're not getting, I always tell everybody to look on the bread you brought home and check out the ingredients. Okay. Talk about food safety. Who wants to eat all that? You know, my bakers, they put on their whole grain, certified organic whole grain. They can call it certified organic grain. I was in the organic food business when it first started in California. CCOF would come by, and we had a restaurant at that time. I was growing food for the restaurant, and we got to do something. They kept telling me, we got to do something. We're going to form this inspection group that'll go around and make sure everybody's organic, because the sloughs were being poisoned. The birds were dying. California was having a rough go back in the 70s. And so that's when the organic movement started. And for crying out loud, look at all the cancer. Cancer is just like the flu now. I don't know anybody who doesn't have it or is about to get it or has died from it. We all know those people. So food safety is more than keeping the rats out of your warehouse and keeping this. And the other thing about food safety is when you look at the food safety record, it's coming from corporate large processors. I haven't heard of a lot of farmers markets having trouble with food safety. Nobody's getting sick out of a farmer's market. They're getting sick from earthbound processing Safeway's spinach, okay? Cargill, hundreds of thousands of pounds of hamburger, okay? Small farms, man, they're not killing people. They're not getting people sick. And the thing about food safety as well, more importantly, is eating a crop, eating food that isn't poisoned by Roundup and everything else that they spray on it. So there's no Roundup on any of my farms. There's no toxic sprays. And the grain, man, it kills the bugs. It moves the bugs to other places. The grain is the most food safety thing you can eat. Look what they've done to grain. It's on every ingredient list. It's nasty. There's nothing left in the grain. There's no nutrition. They've sold it already. They literally sold it. You know, I eat wheat thins. Wheat thins has salt and wheat, organic wheat. You can get organic wheat thins. They're awesome. All they have is in the ingredients, wheat and salt. It's a nice salty snack. But, you know, we're here to produce food safety. When food safety became a reality for us, we're GAP certified, good handling practice certified. When that came and we had to jump those hoops, we all thought it was really bad, just more paperwork, blah, blah, blah. But it was really good for the employees and, the constant updating and meetings we have with the employees about, you know, touching your hands, washing your hands, what can happen when you don't. What happens? It brings everybody's consciousness to the same level. I don't have, English-speaking people on my farm. So we have interpreters that interpret into Spanish what food safety means and how that works and why we do this. No sodas in the field. Man, ever since we got GAP certified, the cans in the weeds, the soda cans in the weeds and all that have gone away. It's a beautiful thing. We built a lunchroom so they can have a nice sit-down lunch area, you know, where they have a stove because they like to cook their own food and all that. It brings the farm and the morale up, the food safety deal. But food safety for me is more than just washing your hands, keeping the rats out. It's providing a nutritious meal that has everything in it that the human body needs. And, we're still going to get sick. I know a lot of foodies that get the cancer and get all this stuff. It's more than just good food, but that's why we do this, is to give people a chance for at least having a good, safe product to eat. So food safety for me is a big, broad picture, big deal.
Yeah, and it is for us as well. I mean, I think that's a really lovely and eloquent answer to the way that we're trying to think of this. This is a part of a systems analysis, and there's so many aspects to our food system, you know, from the soil all the way up to the person that's eating it at the end and everything in between, that we're trying to have that big lens on our food safety work. And one of the things that keeps coming up for us as we talk to growers across the country, I think is particularly interesting when you're talking about heritage grains. You guys are mentioning the length of the stalks, you know, different, you know, soil conditions, growing requirements for different types of grain that we, you know, might not have a history of growing very recently. And I'm curious, what are some of the, you know, knowledge and infrastructure and practicality needs around growing, cross harvesting, processing, and then distribution? And one of the ways that I tie that into some of the work that we're trying to support in this project is thinking about local and regional infrastructure. I wonder, you know, what it looks like for you guys in terms of milling or distribution or storage, and the types of infrastructure that you could use or might need, or the types of technology and tools or just knowledge that you need on your farm. So it can be a on-farm answer to the question, a broader, you know, food and grain ecosystem question, but I'm curious where those things come up for you guys in your production.
Yeah, the whole infrastructure thing, that's a whole nother can of worms. You know, you say, oh, the grain is great, it's really fantastic, it's got all those benefits for everything, but it doesn't do you a bit of good if you can't harvest it, process it, like you say, keep it dry, all the infrastructure. So that's what we're building now. And I'm really thankful the government has come up with a lot of grants. We just applied, Chris just got a little grant money. We applied and were approved a grant. We haven't got the cash in fist yet, but we're this close to, we're about 99% sure we're gonna get it. And that'll get us a dehuller. This is gonna put the fries on the map as far as being a grain guy, because we're going to get a bigger mill, a bagger. We got all this infrastructure that is required to process the grain. Man, when Chris came to me with this grain deal, it just was really so good for me, because now I have a rotation crop. I can have a paying rotation crop. You know, we don't live in a small community. Well, we live in a small community, but they're not all farmers. So we're able to sell a lot of our stuff right here in town. We ship a lot out. Shipping is another thing. I mean, if I had a computer guy, I could be selling this grain on the internet like a lot of folks do and have a whole other revenue stream coming in. That's what I need right now, is a computer guy. Chris has got so much variety. And see, that's the other thing. They said, well, Fry, how are you going to do, keep all this sorted out? Well, I have a mixed batch of barley, this Tibetan barley, and a Rouge de Bordeaux red wheat that got commingled in the combine. Oh, we planted out and the barley looked beautiful. Oh, this is going to be fine. Well, now there's a lot of wheat coming up as well. The wheat sprouted a seed later than the barley. So now I got a pancake mix, I got a biscuit mix, I got a mixed crop out there that, you know, looks stupid, but we're going to sell it, man. We're going to sell every bit of it as a pancake mix, a barley and wheat pancake mix, whole grain, heirloom. Yeah. So, you know, you have to really be creative as a small farm. And you got to take chances. I never knew this stuff would work until we started growing it. And we take a lot of chances out here. The farmers are a risky group of people. They're gamblers, man. And we just keep throwing the dice, and thank God a lot of it hits. People want to eat nutritional food. I'm telling you, we put a farm stand out here, farm store. People said, Fry, what are you doing, man? You're out in the middle of nowhere. And it's build it and they will come. Build it and they will come. And we just pursued this whole warehouse and this farm store out here. And My golly, people appreciate it. People love it. They come out here. We got a music venue. People love that. We had a big 200 people gathering yesterday. People love it. They love coming to the farm. It's the whole, you got to look at the whole small farm picture. Like you said, you know, it's food safety is more than just keeping the rats out of your warehouse. It's what are we eating, people? What are you doing to our food, people? Mm-hmm. Stop it. Stop it.
So as we kind of get here to the end of our conversation, you know, you guys have talked a lot about how you envision you want this product to be a part of people's livelihoods, especially as really fine source wilder grain. You know, for our listeners who maybe not as experienced in learning about these grains, could you speak on the benefit of heritage grains in people's diets and maybe some things they may not know about the benefits of them?
Chris.
Yeah. Mm. yeah, Haley. So Steve just mentioned Tibetan barley and the red Rouge de Bordeaux. And I was like, well, Steve, what about the Tibetan purple barley that you were actually speaking about? Because you left purple out of there. And if there's one of the most ostentatious, no, what's the right word? The most, like, your eyes are just like, wow, like this, is the Tibetan purple barley, because it is violet on fire, like a blueberry in a grain. And so most of us know, like, if the doctor was like, oh, one thing that I would recommend you eat every day or often, blueberries, right? Incorporate blueberries or even just berries. Berries are like anti-cancer medicine. Why are they anti-cancer medicine? Because they're high in anthocyanins. So anthocyanins are what we find in Abronia berries. We find them in wine. We find them in grapes and lots of these purple foods, in purple sweet potatoes. So here we are in Southern Oregon with the Rogue Valley Heritage Grains Project and with multiple growers across our valley growing Tibetan purple barley. We have purple wheat. We have purple legumes. We have fava beans and chickpeas and other things that are purple. We have peas that are purple. Why are we growing purple things? Because they're really nutritious and good for us. Because for those who haven't heard about the report that just came out that said incidences of cancer in youth are skyrocketing right now. And it ain't like the older people so much that we have to worry about cancer. It's all these young people that are now coming down with cancer. Why are they coming down with cancer? Possibly because of the ultra high processed foods that we are eating in our diets. And so when you have the foundation, the building blocks, the things that you can actually get from a local grower, you could even grow it on a quarter acre, half acre to begin with, and possibly you scale up. But nonetheless, you have access to them here locally. You can then take Tibetan purple barley into your kitchen, and that is the foundation of, oh, what am I going to do with this? I think I'll add 30% bread into the other heritage wheat and make bread out of it. I will grind it or pulverize it and make some cereal out of that. You see, because otherwise we have to rely on General Mills. We have to rely on Quaker Oats. We have to rely on
how much vitamin stuff? Is there any
Unilever?
Any vitamin?
All these guys. Yeah, exactly. So the 50 plus thousand processed foods that I mentioned earlier, when there used to be 800, those 50,000, the corporations, they're all like, oh, but there's more nutrition. But the kids, the youth today are getting smarter. And they're realizing, well, wait, those are just vitamins added into a bunch of garbage food, ultra high processed food. can we really say that that's nutrition? And the FDA is like, oh, we've got all these nutritious foods. They're only nutritious because the corporations have stripped all the goodness out and come back in and put a bunch of vitamin pills. And guess what? It is not the same thing. And so I'm grateful. I'm confident that our youth are wising up to this and are going to push back and say, you know what? I'm looking behind the curtain here. I want what's in that farmer's field right over there. That's what I want to make my food of. And making koji or making miso from these lentils, from these legumes, like probiotics, all of these things that we've been talking about could be fermented and made into nutritious beverages like, like water kefir. What am I thinking of that? Yeah, barley. You can ferment all these things and do so many amazing things to enrich the endemic, the indigenous microbes that we have that are in our systems today.
That's what we're talking about, gut health. You know, the veg. We have, the kimchi and we do all that fermenting thing here in the kitchen. We build a kitchen here. Gut health. We have doctors come in and they say, you know what the biggest problem with people today? Their gut health is horrible. Processed food is not getting into this. It doesn't work the same. You know, the sugars from corn, unbelievable what they do to corn. Come on. It's time to just get real, people. You're not healthy. You're not happy. Good food makes you happy.
It's true.
Look at me, I'm smiling. And it ain't because I'm rich monetarily. Okay. You're never going to make a lot of money on a farm. That's just part of the creed. But you're happy because you can go out and you see happy people working. They're dancing in my fields as we speak. Their music is loud. It's fantastic.
These are the foods we need to be subsidizing and not the foods that we're subsidizing in the modern food system, which is, corn, GMO corn and pesticides and glyphosate resistant genetically engineered to be sprayed with the herbicides. We are subsidizing that to the tune of tens of billions of dollars. I've heard even $100, $200 billion goes into that food system and subsidizing all these layers of it, which is actually making us sick with type 2 adult onset diabetes and all these things rampant right now. We need to be subsidizing whole food and food that is complete in and of itself and doesn't need to be added with all these other little special additives that are just more junk.
If the ingredient label on your bag of bread has more than three ingredients, you're not eating good bread. Mm-hmm. That's not going to do you any good.
Seriously, Dave's Killer Bread. Like I've met Dave up in Portland back when he used to do farmers markets. You know, and he came up with, you know, he was a convict and he was like turned his life around and started making his own bread and got this clientele all over Portland and then expanded. And then some big conglomerate multinational corporation came in and bought Dave's bread and gave him millions of dollars. And like, here you go. And then they took it and they added all these ingredients in it that are so unholy, including sugar. If you look at the amount of carbohydrates that are on that label, it's sugar, added sugar, like a teaspoon of sugar per slice of bread. And I'm like, yuck.
It's too much.
I really appreciate this conversation. I think it's also, if you were to have a side-by-side comparison of bread that you got off a shelf in the store that's packaged in plastic versus bread that was baked today, you know, it's so obvious, like in the look, the smell, the texture, the taste, like it's such a... It's just so obvious. And I think it's really true what you're saying about how I think people are definitely waking up to you know, how gut health is very important, and how, you know, thinking, you know, there's a lot of science that says that your gut is related to your brain health too, and how your whole body is functioning. And so if we're really looking into one of the biggest inputs is what we're eating, and if that's making us sick, you know, then there are some very obvious follow-up questions, I think, that we can reckon with culturally. And I think kind of what I'm getting a lot of from this conversation is this discussion of putting the culture in agriculture, if you will, and especially looking forward into the future, what does that culture look like, and how do we want it to look like, and who's involved? And I think it's really important that more people have more direct access, or at least say in what the foods are that they're eating, if they can get to know their farmers even better, if they can even be growing their own grain, that's amazing. So I'm curious, and this is the last question that I have for you all, but and I know, because I know at the Fry Family Farm, you guys do a lot of events and music shows there. So my question is, how can events, mixed media, and, you know, art even fit into the making of a better food system? You know, you're hosting music shows on the Fry Family Farm, and there are annual Heritage Grain Days. Do you think that these can be an effective way to better engage eaters and customers, and even share more information among farmers? How do you see that kind of joining of food and music or art? Because I feel like they're naturally friends. So maybe that's a good place for the culture to kind of percolate, or to kind of create itself.
Sure. I advertise by word of mouth. I let the product sell itself. I've always been a farmer. I've grown a lot of different things. And the only reason I kept growing this business is because at the end of the season, we're sold out. And I do no advertising. We do a CSA year round. I love you guys' culture, your internet activity and all that. We're not savvy enough to do that. We're farmers. We're too busy, you know, growing stuff. I love the idea. Like I said, if I had a computer kit, I'd be selling this stuff on the internet, the grain, because it's non-perishable. I can sell the whole berries. That purple barley that I'm growing out here is so great. Just in we mix it with the rice. My wife cooks the barley and the rice together. Barley takes a little longer to cook, but the two of them together, the barley, it swells and then it pops like popcorn in your mouth. It gives you this stimulus in your mouth. It's just like, what's that? It's the barley. You know, they put barley in soups, whole grain berries. But, you know, and you know, it's a little much for me to broadcast when we're having shows, you know, food, grains, blah, blah, blah. It's more of a relaxation. I want people to be able to come and relax, bring your kids. We have a little kid area where they can play and be wild. It's a farm. Grow wild. It's okay to go anywhere. It's all organic. The greenhouses are open. I don't know how to advertise that actually reaches people. I've been on the board of directors for the Growers Market for many, 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 many years. And advertising to me just seems like throwing money in the wind. Some of it hits, not much of it. It blows away. I don't know how to get the word out. I don't have the technology for it. I don't have the people for it. People come in here and they eat it and they take it. They take it to they send it to their friends in Idaho or Missouri or wherever. And their friends email us, can you send me some more of that grain? So by tasting, word of mouth, this farm store, we've never advertised this farm store out here. Not once. And it's thriving. People get fresh produce. They take it home and make a salad or whatever you do with it. And they want more of it. They want more of it. We got fresh baked goods here. We do a lot of stuff in the kitchen. They come back. They want a pie. We got pies. We use organic sugar. They're organic pies.
We're hoping to have a fall heritage. So we have done two heritage grain days, both in March, one of 2023 and one of 2024 earlier this year. And we're already trying to gear up for getting a date on the calendar for fall.
We need a band. We need band.
We can come up with a band. There's lots of bands for sure that would love to throw down for heritage grain, but we want to gear farmers up for fall planting. And so we're thinking September, October, because late October and into November, the whole month of November are really kind of critical windows for planting heritage grains, because that's when the snow comes. That's when the rain comes. And like Steve was saying, nothing feels better than just to put some seeds out in the field and pull a rake over it and get that seed down for the winter. And then within a couple of weeks, it's growing, and it's all spring. It just is growing, 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 and no water is necessary. No irrigation is necessary. It just is growing, and it's growing not only soil health, but it's growing your food and your community's food. The gluten allergies and things are much less with the einkorn that is 17,000 years old, the emmer that is 8,000-9,000 years old, spelt, and heritage wheats that are thousands of years old. We are growing, and they're more nutritionally dense. They have higher protein, higher vitamin E, higher nutrients in them than modern varieties that have been bred for uniformity and for lodge resistance and shorter.
And for gluten.
And for higher gluten content.
Gluten content. It's grown for gluten content.
Yep. But it's the type that cause issues with people's, mess with people's health, for sure.
That's part of the food safety issue. See, that's the food safety I'm talking about. There's more gluten allergies than I've ever heard of. And that's food safety, man. That's not safe food to eat.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate the expansion of the conversation on food safety. I think that's definitely kind of what we're trying to get at and talking to you about, talking about public health and how what the food that we're eating is definitely more than, yes, washing your hands and sanitizing things, but also it's the whole ecosystem of what are people eating, how is the land responding, how are people's bodies responding, and how is that all connected? Because, it's all connected. So I think if we start asking questions, then we kind of start finding some answers. And I think it's really awesome what you all are doing, and being, in the Rogue Valley too, I would love to see how I could help you guys advance some of your goals. I did go to marketing school, so maybe Steve, I could help out a little bit somewhere. But thank you so much. Haley, Billy, do you have anything final to add, or, any comments?
Just want to thank y'all for spending some of your valuable time in what I'm sure is also a busy season. I know it is for me on the farm. So thanks for taking some time and sharing your stories with us.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it's great to learn about your perspective as growers. And I'm a very avid baker, and I frequent my mill here, Barton Springs, here in Austin. And it's really lovely to just hear your experiences and learn about something new. So thanks for making time for us today.
Definitely.
Well, I wish you were here where I'm sitting. The kitchen's right behind me, and I smell bread baking.
Haley, I'll have to find a way to share some of their grain with you guys.
That's cool.
Please do.
Yeah, I've also been a baker in the past, and it's amazing how, if you're just going to get the cheapest flour on the store shelf, it tastes exactly like nothing, if worse than nothing sometimes. And then when you get those grains from mills or your local growers, it's amazing how different it is. And you're like, oh, bread is actually, or flour actually has a taste to it. It's not just like this bland carrier of nothing. I mean, I don't know how else to really describe it, but it's
I mean, that's what really excites me, is you can actually taste it. Mm-hmm. I didn't taste grain. Rice is rice, you put soy sauce on. Grain is just something you put something on. Bread, but this stuff actually has a flavor to it. It's fantastic. It's very exciting.
Perfect. Well, I wish you all success, continued success, and good luck with all the grain endeavors ahead, and hope to keep in touch with that. So thanks so much for being part of the Food Safety Dish. I think our listeners will be delighted to hear this conversation.
I really appreciate you guys doing this work. It's got to get out to the people. You got to stick, you know, you may not be making a much money, but God loves you.
Thank you, Haley, Billy, Catherine.
Thanks for listening. The Local Food Safety Collaborative is a cooperative initiative established between the National Farmers Union Foundation and the FDA with the goal of providing training, education, and technical assistance to local food producers to ensure good food safety practices and compliance with the Food Safety Modernization Act. Find us on social media at Local Food Safety and let us know questions, topics, or guests you'd like to hear from. National Farmers Union is a grassroots farmer-driven organization that believes strong family agriculture is the basis for thriving communities. NFU's membership includes over 200,000 family farmers and ranchers across America. Farmers Union's grassroots structure promotes locally initiated policy priorities and educational topics established by their members. If you are interested in learning more about NFU and the work that we do, go check out our website at www.nfu.org. This podcast is supported by the Food and Drug Administration of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services as a part of a financial assistance award, 2U01FD006921-04, totaling $1 million with 100% funding by FDA-HHS. The contents are those of the authors and do not necessarily represent the official views of, nor an endorsement by FDA-HHS or the U.S. government. I'm Catherine Cavanaugh, and this has been the Food Safety Dish. Until next time...